You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at SeavillePodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at SeavillePodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. Regular listeners of our podcast might know Rick Britton. He's an historian and cartographer and a frequent guest on WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Rick also designs and hosts Virginia history programs for the Charlottesville Senior Center. In the fall of 2010, the Senior Center offered one of Rick's programs entitled Virginia History 101. Running from October 7 through November 18th, this six-part lecture series was designed for those interested in Virginia's fascinating early history. The lecture for October 21, 2010, was entitled Foodways of the Enslaved. It was presented by Lenny Sorensen, Monticello's African-American research historian, who, besides her duties on Jefferson's Little Mountain, also teaches rural life skills such as canning, butchering, and cookery. Following an introduction of the enslaved individuals laboring in Mr. Jefferson's kitchen, at Monticello, in Paris, and at the White House, Sorensen delivered a fascinating talk on the surprisingly complicated and fashionable meals they prepared. Previously forgotten by history, these cooks and chefs were talented, amazingly literate, and oftentimes multilingual. This is the third in a six-part series for 2010. Here's Lenny Sorensen.
Hello. Good evening. I'm going to tell you a story about a kitchen. Do you want to be able to see better? Or let me know if you can see, because I can't. I have to reposition this chair, this table, which I'm quite willing to do if you can. If you can't see, good. Now, like all such utilitarian places, kitchens, it's a place where foodstuffs were washed and pared and chopped and cooked and dished, and they were taken to the dining table. But you'll notice that in this little description, I haven't actually said anything about folks, any human agency. The food was carried. That's what the sign used to say outside the kitchen at Monticello. For far too long, in the stories of the great groaning board feasts of Virginia and the Tidewater, the food seems to have just kind of appeared out of nowhere, out of the ether. It was cooked and dinner was served. And throughout much of the 19th and much of the 20th centuries, the narrative, especially in cookbooks by white authors, was slowly allowed to hint at the people doing the work. But the language used demanded a stereotype rather than a reality. We heard of the black cook, informed by, let's see if we can make this do it, what's supposed to, aha, did it. Informed by instinctual and natural abilities derived and maintained from their putative African heritage. In the words of John Edgerton, who was a wonderful, fine food writer, it became fashionable to regard the new generation of kitchen help with benign indulgence. There were turbaned mammies in the language. There were voodoo magicians, tyrants of the kitchen, who ruled the back rooms with simple-minded power. They could work culinary miracles day in and day out, but couldn't for the life of them tell anyone how they did it. In 1955, the food writer and entrepreneur Duncan Hines, many of us will have grown up making Duncan Hines cake mixes. He is the man who essentially created that form. He was still waxing eloquent on Southern food traditions and the inarticulate mysteries of the black cook. He said, "Many Southern ladies had Negro cooks to help them, and just how much we owe to their skill, I have no way of knowing, except that almost all of the finest Southern dishes are of their creating, or at least bear their special touch." They cooked by instinct, these artists of the saucepan and skillet, like a musician who cooks by ear and measured everything as a smidgen of this and a pinch of that, and their educated hands could tell when bread or pie crust felt just right. "But what is a smidgen?" asks Hines. "Or a pinch? I don't know. And I'm sure the cooks did not either." or if they knew, it was their way of keeping secret their own recipes. He closes with a very telling confession. I've spent hours in southern kitchens watching these cooks and trying to learn from them just how much of what went into what dish that I particularly enjoyed. Well, such condescension, of course, left out real people living real lives in slavery or Jim Crow segregation. And if the wonderful food could be ascribed to some sort of instinctual racial magic, then we're not required to recognize the intellect and the skill of the individuals producing the meals. Even such a well-respected food historian as the late Karen Hess searched to identify what she referred to as some sort of African version of wok presence, W-O-K, as in the Chinese wok, in the culinary skills of African-American cooks in her descriptions of antebellum cookery. This, despite the fact that most cooks of African descent working in elite kitchens throughout the 18th and 19th centuries tended to be American-born, often by several generations, English-speaking, and Christian. Okay? So I would argue that supposed instinct comes from experience. It takes 10, 20, 40 years of hands-on cooking to make the work seem effortless or magical. Sending 30 beautifully prepared dishes to the table, as was common in the antebellum period in homes, of, especially for festivities, takes planning, choreography, decision-making, split-second timing, care, thought, physical strength, and endurance. Only with those attributes in place can the culinary performance be described as instinctual. In this story I will be telling today, the food is important, but the stars of the story will be Edith Hearn Fawcett and Frances Gillette Hearn, sisters-in-law, cooks, chefs even, mothers and wives, and slaves in the community of the enslaved owned by Thomas Jefferson at Monticello. In this story, the kitchen is right there. In this story, the kitchen is the stage, the food is the dressing, pun intended, and Edith, Francis, Peter, James, and Ursula are the actors. The script has an air of improvisation because Jefferson only wrote down what interested him at any given moment, and his daughter and granddaughters were not dedicated housekeepers in the manner of their cousin, the cookbook writer Mary Randolph. Thus, we have some idea of individual favorite dishes, especially desserts, but little idea of whole menus. We start with the cast. Two Ursulas. James Hemings, Peter Hemings, Edith Hearn Fawcett, Frances Gillette Hearn, and Hannah, who was at Poplar Forest. We see Ursula the Elder, who cooked for Martha Wales Jefferson, her granddaughter Ursula the Younger. We see James and Peter. We see their ancillary cousin, second buttonhole, you know how complicated families were. We see Edith and we see Frances. So they're part of the web of family genealogy. Now, over a 9-year period, three different young women from Monticello were trained at the president's house to meet the demands of Thomas Jefferson's dining style. They were each related by blood and or eventually marriage to four major family groups at Monticello: the Hearns, the Gillettes, the Hemingses, the Hughes, and the Fawcetts. Actually, that's five, Hearns, Gillettes, but just shows how numerous I am. I thought I would just do that so that you wouldn't walk away thinking, wow, shit. The women followed in the footsteps of previous extended family members who cooked for Jefferson. Originally serving as Jefferson's body servant, in 1784, James, that you see right in the middle there next to Peter, accompanied Jefferson to Paris for, as Jefferson wrote, the particular purpose of learning French cookery. This is a boy who started out, this 19-year-old, began his life of service as a 10-year-old as a body servant to Jefferson. So he'd known him literally almost all in this service way all of his life. He did everything from capture mockingbirds which Jefferson liked to keep in cages, to holding his horse, to polishing his shoes, to accompanying him wherever he went. He was a man who knew Jefferson's tastes, Jefferson's friends, Jefferson's landscape, the world through which Jefferson moved as an adult man, Baltimore, Annapolis, New York, Richmond. He was at his side through those experiences. So that by the time he's 19, it's pretty clear that he's a perfect person to go and learn this. He has been in the homes of the highest elite, around the highest elite servants and servant staff, and he fulfills all the things that a servant needs to do. He doesn't put himself forward, he gets everything done, he's trustworthy, all of that. So he takes him. And there in Paris, the 19-year-old begins his apprenticeship with Monsieur Combeau, who was a caterer, and then also with a pastry chef and a chef in the household of the Prince of Condé, one of the most elegant, elite homes where the meals are of the highest order. Now, James, you can imagine this kid from the New World, America, that the French have helped create, but he's dropped, here's this this young man, into this kitchen. And you can just bet your boots that nobody there made any accommodation for the fact that he probably didn't speak French. Okay? He had to learn on the job really fast, and it is more than likely that, it's certainly pretty clear that he was able to live up to that. By 1787, he had begun his work as the chef de cuisine in Jefferson's house on the Champs-Élysées, and he was earning a wage. And back in the United States in 1790, he was cooking for Jefferson in New York City and Philadelphia. He was shopping at the markets. He was acting as butler. He was performing all those roles that we know would be essential to the creation of a fine dining experience for Jefferson's many guests and for Jefferson himself. In 1793, Jefferson, I always say Jefferson and Hemings struck a bargain, when actually Jefferson struck a bargain, because you notice that Hemings' name isn't on this contract. Jefferson strikes a bargain that in exchange for formal manumission, Hemings would return to Monticello, quote, "There he shall have taught such person as I shall place under him for the purpose to be a good cook." Now, the person turned out to be Peter Hemings, James's younger brother, and Peter continued to be the major cook at Monticello through the presidential years until 1809. Obviously, James had the skills to teach his brother, who obviously had the skills to learn this occupation and to perform it well. Upon his inauguration and his move into the president's house in 1801, Jefferson had Ursula, that's way back on the genealogy, that Ursula the granddaughter, come. She was the daughter of Bagwell and Minerva, the granddaughter of great George and Ursula, and she was sent to Washington to learn the art of pastry making, which, as you can well imagine, in a time when desserts were an extraordinarily important last piece on a table of the elite, to have that skill would be very important. So she goes, she's 15 years old, and she stays in Washington for about 6 months. And when she returned home, she would then work alongside Peter Hemings whenever Jefferson was present at the house acting as a pastry cook. And the rest of the time, she worked, as they called it at the day, in the ground, which means she was a field worker. So in the fall of 1801, Edith Hearne Fawcett, again an age 15, was sent to Washington to begin training as a cook under Jefferson's chef, Honoré Julien. She was joined there in 1806 by her 18-year-old sister-in-law, Frances Gillette Hearne. And the question that we can ask is, why might those two young girls be chosen for this task? And my thinking goes kind of like this. Well, at Monticello during the 1790s, it was their cousin James who taught his own brother what he'd learned in Paris. And Edith and Frances were the exact right age to begin their life of work, usually in a modest way, part of a day or part of an afternoon, doing some kind of work. Baby minders, we know that Edie was a baby minder for one of Sally Hemings' little daughters, the one that died, Harriet that died. So she's in the precinct of the House already. And she would have, the two of them would have probably been brought into that precinct and tested, as it were, as scullions, because that's the basic where you start. And so they would have, you know, done a lot of the mundane chores. They would have stirred pots and grated sugar, salt, and washed vegetables and carried things and answered the call whenever Edith or Francis. And their tractability, their ability to be in that setting and not get rattled, to follow directions clearly, to obey, to not be raucous or any of the other kind of childish kinds of things, would probably have helped set them apart as being ideal to work in the kitchen. So by the time they get to Washington, the ways in which a well-run kitchen that produces one major meal every single day and a breakfast every single day would have been part already of their work experience. Oh, okay. It's okay, Jefferson. Okay. Now, we know that James Hemings could read and write a fine hand, and in a little while we'll see an example of that. And we know that his younger brother, John Hemings, who was a carpenter and a skilled joiner, some pieces of whose work are still at Monticello that we cherish, could read and write. But we don't have any kind of general overarching idea of literacy at Monticello. But certainly given the extraordinary high value placed on literacy, the enormous numbers of books/newspapers available at Monticello, and the fact that these several very important people are literate, would lead me to believe that in many cases people are learning to read kind of under the cover, and they're not broadcasting it. Because certainly by the time that I'm speaking of, there were tensions within the Virginia Assembly about people being allowed to read or being taught to read, and all kinds of punishments for the fear that people would write forged passes. But it was inconvenient not to have among your household staff people who could read. It just was often a deeply inconvenient thing. So part of the permeability of slavery, you know, that despite the law, we know what the law says, and then we know what people do. And what people do often are deeply, they deeply contravene the law. And I'm talking about white folks, not just black folks. So it's hard to know. But certainly by the time the girls, as they were always called, get to Washington, they are ready to be under the tutelage of Honoré Julien, who spoke a variety of Frenglish so amusing that you have to read his letters if you ever have an opportunity. I'm sure he, too, did not defer. He would use culinary French terms, and he would have spoken to them, and then they were now in a household where Le Maire, the head maître d', and Honoré Julien and Jefferson could all converse in French. So they would have been present within that dynamic. And whether they spoke French or even understood its grammar is not important, but they undoubtedly knew all of the kinds of French culinary terms, some of which we today, of course, use with, you know, just casual abandon, sauté for one, you know, and others. So they were ready for the kinds of meals that were often presented in this day. This is a small dessert for winter, for a table at which, and we can see that you have jellies. You know, we might just casually say, oh, jellies, except that all jellies were made from calf's feet. It took about a 2-3 day preparation of many steps in order to do it, that in order to produce a gelatin that had so little savory taste in it that then when you added the lemon or the fruit or the other flavors, that would be the flavor of it, and yet that would gel lovely in a clear wine glass, and would just be a beautiful presentation. So the results of their training is also seen by the kinds of responses to the meals. Quote, never before had such dinners been given in the president's house, said one Washington resident. Quote, the dinner was excellent, Benjamin Latrobe said this, cooked rather in the French style, larded venison, he notes, the dessert was profuse and extremely elegant. Here we just see a kind of sample of what extremely elegant might mean that you had to be part of. So, let's see here. Did I have that? Nope. Okay. The meal served on April the 3rd of 1807 was about as simple as it got at the president's house. There were several politicians who were in attendance. It wasn't a dinner party or anything special, but this is what they had. This is 1807. Under Honoré Julien's direction, Edith prepared his specialty, partridge with sausages and cabbage, while Francis would probably have begun the dessert custard. And in the table setting slide that they showed back there, each dish had its real particular placement on the table. There was a correct, so cooks not only had to know how to prepare the food, how to elegantly plate it, but then they had to know how it was going to be set and juxtaposed one against the other in this decorative pattern on the table. So they had a sense of the fashion of it, the style of it, the changing fashions. Nothing is quite as quixotic as changing fashions, be they in skirt lengths, jackets, hats, or the dinner table. And so they would have been part of understanding that because that's the world of service that they lived in. So the ham of bacon, what we call a baked ham, was in the center, and around it was a spit-roasted quarter of bear. It had been aging for 6 days, and we know this because Lemaire mentions that he bought it. We have these wonderful records. And in the market, we know it was April, and we know he'd just bought it, and it would have been hanging there. Now, a quarter of a bear, well, the bear that was on my porch, a quarter of that bear would be really big. So I don't know how big this quarter of a bear was, but it certainly would have made a startling presentation in the center of the table. And a beef bouilli, which would have been served at practically every single dinner meal, and that for us would be like a braised pot roast. That's kind of with vegetables. Okay, that's just a standard thing. That and a ham, practically at any kind of meal. You always had at least four kinds of meats, and many times six, every single meal, every day. Okay, just keep saying that to yourself every time I mention it. Oh yeah, every single day, all year. No, we have breakfast. We haven't got to breakfast. We're just talking about dinner. Okay. So, but also, so you had that. They had a soup, potatoes, rice, spinach, beans, lettuce salad, and pickles. And after the course was finished, the servants removed the dishes, and the head chef placed the main dessert, described by one of the men present, so we know this is actually the day that they actually ate this, a kind of custard with a floating cream on it. Anyone had Floating Island? A magnificent silken custard with a beautiful meringue thing beautifully placed with probably a sugared violet sitting on each one that would have been gorgeous in a nice, you know, really, really lovely. Okay, so there was that. And it was surrounded by complimentary sweets. It says, apples enclosed in a thin toast. Sounds like baked apples in a crust to me. And, quote, on each side, four dishes and three in the middle of cakes and jellies. And it was only after the dessert was finished and the tablecloth removed that the wine was served. And this is where Jefferson really differed in terms of the way he entertained. He served wine after. He did not serve hard spirits when he could get away with it, but certainly at the dinner table. But the wine was Portuguese Madeira, Spanish Pajarete, French Hermitage, and Italian Nebbiolo, kind of an ecumenical array of wine. And then in more than 12 dishes around the table were olives, apples, oranges, and nuts. So the gentlemen are sitting around the table afterwards. They're sipping their wine. They're continuing their conversation. The servants have been bringing in these things and clearing all the things. And that's so when Edith and Francis get back to Monticello, this parochial backwater of a house that is hardly finished, as you all know, he was constantly in the state, they are certainly prepared for what the demands are going to be put on them. Years later, in 1824, Daniel Webster recalled, quote, "Dinner is served in half Virginian, half French style, in good taste and abundance." So we know that these were, you know, definitely, and I'm trying to make sure that I, okay. What you see here is a picture of table settings, and you see knives and forks, which we just kind of think of as, you know. But you see those three tines, and they're still a little problematic. But what they were replacing were these. And how many people know that poem? "I eat my peas with honey. I've done so all my life. It makes the peas taste funny, but it keeps them on the knife." My black grandfather from Sabine County, Texas, born in 1872, taught me that poem when I was a girl. I don't know if he knew quite why it was funny yet, you know, all those years later, but it reflects a way of a transition, again, of style and fashion and culinary stuff that old-fashioned people, as late as, you know, 1815 or 20, were still eating in the old-fashioned knife way. And, of course, how you did that genteelly was you, as long as you kept the sharp edge, which is this edge to the right, facing out. So you ate on the wide spatulate end, and you did it this way. You brought it. There was a whole way of arrangements. And, of course, you can see these forks are basically useless for peas, certainly. So there's a lot of different transitions going on in the culinary world that Edith would have known. Here's Lemaire's writing about the different kinds of foods, wine that went with different kinds of food when he was at the White House. And here we have the next element of technology that Jefferson was very well aware of. Very early in the 16th century, the raised hearth was now beginning to be explored, and the masonry stove and stew stoves. Who's heard of Count Rumford, Benjamin Count Rumford? You know, two or three people. He built on that technology to design stoves for soldiers on the move, to the degree that our Revolutionary soldiers who encamped at Yorktown and there built these kind of built-in stew holes, and you can still see the remnants of them. And so it was part of a general technology. Jefferson was the kind of guy, of course, who read architectural books. And he's the kind of guy that if he visited your house and you said, "Oh, would you like to see the house?" he'd say, "Yes." And he really meant it, and he wanted to see the whole house. Okay, so any of these palaces and places that he went to, and certainly within architecture books, there were always depicted these images. And even long before Paris, when the kitchen was in the basement of the South Pavilion, the very first building at Monticello, there was a two-hole stew stove. Because in order to do the kind of cookery that the elite, the highest elite who had any kind of international aspirations or definitely experience, that used copper pots and other forms of rather more elite cookware, you have to have that. Just merely a hearth literally will not do you. So he had that, and you can see in a drawing like this, here's stew stoves, and this is a stew stove. So he's got stew holes. I'm sorry, those squares in the cuisine, which is the kitchen, would be stew holes, and you put the coals on in them, and you could raise the pots up and down. And so in the same way, if any of us were drawing a house design, even a fantasy house, the house we want when we grow up, and we have the kitchen, we'd always place the stove and we'd place the refrigerator, even if we don't know exactly what it's going to be like. And so in reading these early architecture books, he would have seen this design readily. So when we see this, we say, is what we say. This is what the kitchen looked like after the Restoration in about 1920. Okay. as a reinterpretation all over the country in many, many historic houses, began to, for the first time, to kind of put together their vision. It's a very terra, a kind of a skewed vision that has to do with more with people living in intrepid pioneers living in log cabins and swarming across the countryside in indomitable whatever. Okay. That becomes the tale. So, of course, it becomes very hard to tell some other elite tale, even if they knew it, which would appear on some levels many people didn't know it. And so the vision of the, what is the most odd thing about that picture? Somebody must see it. The gun. The gun? I won't go there, okay? We can see that this is not a kitchen in which you can produce the kinds of things that we know were produced in the kitchen. Are the dishes like? On a certain level, this to me looks really unappetizing, but it's a really good example of how people like things that we don't like now, but they liked then. Okay, it's called force meat, salmon quenelle. It would have been salmon or other kinds of fish poached, rubbed through a screen to make it very, very fine, in the same way we'd use our Cuisinart today, seasoned, and then made into these nice shapes, and then poached again. They would have egg mixed with it. And so, I'd be poached in a copper pot that could be really regulated because you don't want to boil and you don't want all that stuff. So that isn't that kitchen we just looked at. It's just not. So when we see in our mythic tale of foodways, we see often this style. I am not in any way dismissing the wonderful, hearty, rich, bountiful, imaginative, and just definitely stick-to-itive kind of meals that came out of the iron pot cookery. This happens to be in Baton Rouge. Here I am cooking over the fire at Monticello. Here is the complex, what I call the iron pot cookery. Okay, it's going to make a certain kind of variety, of a repertory of meals. But it's not going to make salmon quenelle and floating island and cream sauce and the various kinds of things that we know are daily parts of what was happening. So in 2003, as they decided that the kitchen at the bottom corner, the rebuilding there was going to be restored, they learned everything they could, archaeologically and otherwise, to say, okay, what was in this kitchen? And some part of that meant taking that whole space apart, which they did, determining where things had actually been, as opposed to kind of surface fantasizing about what they might have been. Here's Henry, master mason, rebuilding the actual oven, the actual hearth. Then you see the bake oven hole over there. Here it is finished. You see the edge of the frame here to the left, the edge of the frame of the stew stoves that you're going to see here in just a minute. There we go. Okay, this is like having an 8-burner Viking range. Does anybody in this room have 8 burners to cook on? I'm so glad nobody raised their hand because I would have cried. Okay, and I teach cooking and I don't have 8 burners. So it's the height of the most elegant technology of its time. It can do all the things that you need to have it do. And there it is, ready to be used. There's trivets of varying heights. Until you could actually turn on a dial and turn on the gas or turn on the electricity, the trick with cooking on an iron cook stove or a hearth or a stew stove was how close you, moving the pots more or less distant from the flames, and then how much coals or other heat source you put under them or sometimes on top of them. So that that's the beauty of that. Here it is finished with the spit jack. This beautiful, this is an actually French one that would have been, takes 10 minutes for it to actually has a weight that hangs down, and you wind it, and then the weight starts sinking down, and it turns that spit that's down there, because roasted meat, particularly beef, would have been the standard for meat. They didn't bake meat. What they might call a baked ham, if you look at Mary Randolph's cookery book, she would poach a ham till the bone was loose. Then she would put it on take it out, take the skin off, bread it with very fine breadcrumbs, and bake it in a very hot oven, very fast. This had to be early in the baking process. Okay, very fast till it was very crispy brown on the outside, but of course very poached, tender, moist on the inside. So you didn't bake a whole ham the way we have come much more to do in our traditions. Here's the kitchen again with some examples. These are pots and pans, not from Jefferson himself, but of this period. So you can see the beauty of the copperware. He came back with 92 boxes full of stuff, of which a considerable number of those boxes were for the kitchen. Here it is today. Please, if you have not been to see the kitchen, come see the kitchen. It has a wonderful impact when you're standing in it and try to look at the idea of what must have been going on there every day. Here's the kitchen restoration at Poplar Forest, which, by the way, they are now cooking in I'm not sure if a daily basis, but on some routine interpretive place. And as you can see, it is a smaller flip of the Monticello kitchen. Stew stoves on this side, only three. Set kettle, that's what that big hole is. It would have had a big copper kettle in it, its own flue underneath to keep hot water in, so that you always had hot water. Did we turn those lights on ourselves? Tell them I'm going to. Yeah. Hey, guys. And the bake oven over at the side. I haven't gotten down there yet to see how they're doing that, but I'm sure that it must be a lot of fun.
I have a question.
Yes.
On the restored kitchen at Monticello, approximately how many people would be cooking at one time?
There would probably always be Francis and Edith and a number of sculleries and assistants, maybe as many as 10, 12 people in and out of there. It took that much. It's not partly because today so many of the things that we would that need to be done by people in Jefferson's day come to us already done. The sugar's already pounded. The salt's already granulated. The chickens are already plucked. There's running water. There's just a lot of variables, so that everything had to be wood in, ashes out, water in, slops out, chicken guts out, feathers out, chickens in, singeing, all of the activities that took a lot of people labor. This is the James Hemmings inventory. It's the only thing we have in James Hemmings' hand, but I want you to look at it because while it's also wonderful to tell us what Edith could possibly ordinarily expect to do in her kitchen with these tools, we also see the beautiful handwriting of this man. Surely no less legible than Mr. Jefferson's neat hand. He uses an abundance of capital letters, whereas Jefferson uses a minimal of capital letters. But other than that, his spelling is no more idiosyncratic. Remember, it's Andrew Jackson that said, "I'd never trust a man who couldn't spell a word two ways." So, you know, they live in a time when it's not in the slightest bit improper to spell in a very, highly idiosyncratic manner. But here we have, let's say, 19 copper stew pans, 6 small saucepans, 3 copper baking molds, 2 small preserving pans, 2 large preserving pans ditto, that's how the convention of the time, 2 copper fish kettles, 2 copper braising pans, 2 round large braising pans, iron stew pans, boiling kettles, tinned inside so it can be used in with a particular kind of, you could use it with acid kinds of things, large brass kettles, pewter work dishes. Just, it's a lovely, lovely list. And even more precious by this man who bargained for his freedom. And this is what we have left. So I cherish it. Yes, ma'am.
What time of day were these huge banquets starting?
Generally between 3 and 4 on almost all plantations. That's about the dinner time. Sometimes it was a little seasonal, depending on the weather. But they wanted to eat while there was still light enough to actually see. And even wealthy people, you know, might not expend a lot of candles. Some extraordinarily elaborate meals that you read about, the wedding, midnight wedding suppers, when they would have had scores of candles and people would have danced until late. So there were some extraordinary late night events. But your standard day supper, your dinner time, was sometime in the mid to late afternoon. And they ate breakfast anywhere, and I'm taking this across the culture, anywhere from probably 6 o'clock in the morning until, say, 9. You know, somewhere in there, depending on who you were and where you were. Then, of course, as we move and become an even, as we move westward, that dinner hour slides closer and closer to noon, 1 o'clock. You know, so by the time I'm living in South Dakota, all the people there call dinner what we call lunch. And then they call the meal they eat at 6, supper. Yeah. So it sounds like many of you certainly know people that would have lived that way. Here's a breakfast at Monticello, 1804, Margaret Bayard Smith. Let me just say, her 40 years in Washington, a volume that's available in most research libraries, is perhaps one of the most wonderful books to read if you want to read about one woman's life experiences, her observations. She writes the most gorgeous letters to her sisters and to others. Detailed, she has an eye for detail. She tells us about the visit of Harriet Martineau. She talks about coming to Monticello. It's a wonderful, wonderful book, and Rick would have the citation for that. But if you want to read a woman, and then she wrote fiction too. So you can get an insight into the world of Washington, D.C. in its first decade as our capital city. Just incredible stuff. Really, really nice. But she tells us, so we got to have tea. We have to have coffee. They have the coffee roaster, so they're roasting the coffee. So these beans are coming green. They've got Peter's muffins. Well, and they often have hot chocolate. It's not on this list, but they have a chocolate duck, the silver duck. Okay, so they have hot chocolate, which they have to prepare. Peter's muffins, which is a kind of like an English muffin, but it has to be made very, very fresh and served very, very fresh, because I have made it, and I'm going to tell you, in 45 minutes, it's a hockey puck. You could kill people. On me, it won't. Okay. But when fresh, is lovely, slightly tart. It's a batter, a very loose batter that's been allowed to sit all night, so it's just slightly slightly tart, and it's baked on a griddle. It's really super. But wheat rolls, cornbread muffins, both of which had to be raised with yeast. They didn't have any leavening. So cornbread made with yeast is a whole other animal, and it's really quite delicious. If you ever want to try that, you can go online, and you can add, there's some recipes out there for it. It's a very unique flavor, and especially with homegrown or some of our best cornmeal that, you know, we have available here in this county from other local places, Wade's Mill and other places, with the freshest of cornmeal and good eggs and good milk and yeast. It's just really quite singular. And then, of course, they have cold ham. And cold ham means hot ham, sooner or later. Do you know what I mean? So how many hams are they cooking a week such that every morning they have cold ham sliced? Plus butter, which they're sometimes buying from overseers' wives. They're sometimes making using their own cattle or cow, however many they might have. And some of that's iffy. The documentation isn't as clear as we would like, so we're not exactly sure where all that butter's coming from. And then jellies, which would, of course, been made during the season. That's every morning. Every morning. 14, 15, 16, 18, 20 people. Never less than 12. So, unfortunately, as you can see, this is an old slide, and I'm going to need to replace this, because our Monticello dining room has been officially repainted, chrome yellow. It will knock your socks off. It is really quite beautiful. And so into this dining room is where the food would have gone. And Margaret Baird Smith kind of remarks on this muffins and hot bread, because at that time, many people worried that hot bread, you know, it's steamy and it's kind of moist, was not good for the digestion. Remember, they're still captive of the four humors. They know nothing about germs. They have very decided, very different. As much as the people of the past sometimes really seem so much like us, we really do have to remember that they are really different in a worldview that we just, it's hard to even imagine it because we've just had it so inured to us. They truly have no idea. Thus, he can have open cesspit, all the chambers upstairs for the chamber pots upstairs. They have open vents that to keep the air kind of moving through them and going up through the roof. Okay, those three vents are right where, when you come up the all-weather passage from the kitchen, you walk right past them as you go to the office to finish putting the meal together to go upstairs. Okay. Now, I'm not saying that that's inherently germy. It's just unattractive, certainly. Okay, but they live in a world full of chamber pots, cow manure, horse manure, ox manure, pig manure, chicken shit, dunghill fowl, people who die quickly and out of their time, children who die often and young, and do it at home. All of these things are all happening within the context of the house, even in so elite a home as Jefferson's home. Martha's giving birth to babies. Black women are giving birth to babies. People are dying and being sick at a time when they have no toilet paper, no paper towels, no germ theory, no running water. Okay, enough said. I won't go too much further in that. But you can certainly see that they truly do live in a different world than ours. And we have to kind of, every once in a while, remind ourselves of that so that we don't graft our present-day stuff onto them. And I've been doing this for a long time, and I even more so maybe than even most people, I have to remind myself of that so that I don't misinterpret what I want it to be. I would love to be able to have it how I want it to be, but it ain't that way. Here's an example of a dinner for 12. Late summer. I've just used Mary Randolph as part of my, kind of my ideas. So we've got okra, we have a bouilli, we have ham, we've got cod sounds, which is codfish were pretty big, and it's part of the cod about like here. I've never seen one. I've just seen pictures. But I am going to examine this more closely because I think I can probably get hold of something like that to see what that was. It was one of Jefferson's very favorite fish dishes. So I want to know how it was prepared. What about it did he like? I don't know. I truly can't tell you. And he bought them by the barrel salted. Okay, I see one order. He ordered 16 barrels of salted herring for his slaves, and he bought 3 barrels of salted cod sounds for himself. Turkey, chicken pudding, macaroni pie. We know that he had macaroni pie because somebody told us in his reminiscence that he had this really weird thing. It looked like stringlings of onions I couldn't really figure out. And then I had to ask Mr. Merriweather what it was. He said, oh, it's a kind of noodle. And it was macaroni and cheese. But this man, from wherever it was he was from, probably pleased to be eating at the White House and having this table be a little foreign to him. If he was the elite of Kentucky, it meant that he was probably kind of a backwoodsman. And to be served this very different dish caused him to actually have to ask Mr. Merriweather Lewis what it was. But we know that at his table, just as Mary Randolph's tables at Moldavia, in Richmond, and then again at her boarding house. There were many kinds of vegetables served and loved and made in very beautiful ways, say French beans and cabbage and artichokes and wheat rolls and fritters and just all the stuff, just really great stuff. Did somebody else have a hand? Snow eggs are those, it's almost like floating island. It's that same, there's several names for this. When I read the recipe, it seems very much like that. It's a meringue in some way that's been, and so here we have an interesting contrast. We have sauce espagnole, a sauce that any good fine French chef would know how to make. It's like knowing how to make Worcestershire sauce, which, of course, I don't know how to make Worcestershire sauce. I could learn, you know, I'm sure I could find a recipe. But a cook of Edith and Francis's accomplishments would have known how to make this sauce. And when we see it in compared with I never can find them. Greta, Edie. And, well, Frances is on there. But there's Edie with her little babies on the bread list. She's not eating leftovers in this kitchen, nor are her family members, nor are any of the scullions. If you learn nothing else from this talk, one of the greatest mythological comfort tellings about slavery is, oh, well, you know, they often got to eat the leftovers, and they got a lot of used clothing. No, as in N-O. That is not, it is so unlikely, it is so rare that we see it in wills when somebody leaves somebody a jacket. I mean, it is, clothing was always at a premium even for elite people. And food was always at a premium because I always had so many people to feed, and they just repurposed whatever was left over. And everything was kept locked, and they're sure, if they're keeping the sugar and the spices and the brandy and the thing locked, why is it that they're going to give the leftover thing that was made with the sugar and the brandy and the raisins to an enslaved person? They're not. It just is not a reality. In many places, in the very as slavery moves westward, and families are living in much more primitive circumstances as they wait to build a bigger house, as they're opening up their cotton lands, it is likely that a household that would have two or three house servants in a cabin while they're waiting to build their household that might have eaten the same food. But they're all eating pretty primitive food in that circumstance. They're not eating this elite food. So this sauce espagnole stands at direct variance with what are they getting as rations? A peck of cornmeal, you know, which is a glass gallon jar, a peck of cornmeal, three dried fish, sometimes some molasses, sometimes some salt, once a week per adult slave, and in diminishing amounts for their children as they become full working hands. So Edith and Francis have this dual vocabulary, which means that not only are they able to make a sauce that is made with cloves and sweet oil, which is olive oil, and champagne, these are just to name three imported items of great value, and to condense it and to do it and constrain it and make this incredible sauce that's then put in jars and then used to season things. That's what it's for. But they also have, are part of the community at Monticello that are growing their own gardens in order to survive, because nobody, especially not a woman that works essentially seven days a week, house servants were usually on call, and cooks the way that she cooks, and had six children during Jefferson's retirement years, could have lived on a peck of cornmeal, three dried fish, and some salt. So we see in this page from Anne Carey Randolph's housekeeping records, one of the most wonderful documents that we have, that within the slave community, they had to have their own gardens. You've got women, You've got pregnant women, lactating women, young children, young adults, adult laborers, and the elderly. And they all have to eat, and they can't live on that. And they do so by their enterprise of their own garden spaces that are, you want me to get done? Well, too bad. You're all stuck. I'm not letting you go anywhere. I'm almost done here. And so let me just close with the bounty that the gardens are bringing in for the slave community of which Edith and Francis are a part, totally separate from their deeply skilled and professional lives as cooks in Jefferson's kitchen. Just on one Sunday, they sold 3 cimlings, 6 cabbages, 16 dozen eggs, 11 chickens, 1.5 dozen cucumbers, a watermelon, a muskmelon, and 1 fish unnamed of type. Just one Sunday. And that was being sold into the Jefferson economy.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.